Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart. It's been a decade since Linda Ronstadt last sang on stage. The 10-time Grammy winner and 26-time nominee first emerged in the late 60s as a folk and pop artist with a uniquely powerful voice. She'd go on to record hits like You're No Good, When Will I Be Loved, and Blue Bayou, as well as recording Don't Know Much with Aaron Neville and releasing two albums with Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris. Later in life, she lent her voice to the jazz standards, operettas, and Mexican folk music that she'd grown up listening to in Arizona. But beginning in the 1990s, Ronstadt began to feel her voice deteriorating. Later, she would receive a Parkinson's diagnosis, and she stopped performing in 2009. She's been awarded the Latin Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and received the National Medal of Arts and Humanities from President Obama in 2014. And now, her life and career are documented in the film Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice, which features interviews with the likes of Dolly Parton, Emmylou Harris, Jackson Brown, Bonnie Raitt, and even Ronstadt herself. Here's a clip.
Feeling better, 'cause I'm over you.
I'm a ballad singer. I like to sing ballads best, but we needed some tempo songs for the record. And as an afterthought, I had this song that we used to close the show.
She knew and loved the song. I knew and loved the song. And we decided to do a version of that song. I stayed up all night assembling this very complicated, intricate, layered guitar piece. We worked very long into like the next afternoon. And that's when Linda turned up and didn't like it. She said, oh, I don't like it. It sounds like the Beatles, which it did sound like the Beatles. But in the end, she came around and said, you know what? I was wrong. It's great.
The film comes out September 6th, and its directors, Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, join me now. Gentlemen, welcome to All of It.
Thank you for
having
me.
Good to be here.
All right, so with every film, especially something like this, I always ask, why now? Why this film? Why now?
Well, her story hasn't been told before. She wrote an autobiography called Simple Dreams, and we read her book and thought, somebody has to make a film about this, and we hope it will be us. We approached her, and she was initially very reluctant. She didn't think there'd be an audience for it. She really thought her time had come and gone, and she was fine with that. And fortunately, we prevailed, and she came on board.
Okay, I was going to say, her not thinking that people would be interested seems to be a theme that we'll circle back to.
Yeah.
But yeah, why was it that this film, when you get into it, we learn so much more about this incredible artist that I think most people only think of as, you know, this rock star, this, you know, woman who was able to fill arenas and, you know, like roll with the boys. But she had a fascinating childhood.
She did. She grew up in a musical household 45 minutes north of the Mexican border in Arizona. And her family was very musical, as I said, but there are all kinds of music in her home. That's where she listened to traditional Mexican music, but also American standards, operetta, Gilbert and Sullivan. And so that when she became a hugely successful, like the most successful female recording artist at that point of all time, and still one of the most successful recording artists of all time, she was not content to just keep doing what she was doing. She had all this other music in her that she needed to explore. So she went on to sing operetta and American standards and do things that her record company was not necessarily happy with when she went off on these tangents. But it was something she had to do as an artist. She was never content to just be a pop star.
Well, clearly. One of the things that I love especially about films about rock stars from the 60s and 70s is that you learn how much of an insular little musical community existed, because it seems like she worked with or, you know, helped mentor or something most of the important artists of at least that late 60s, early 70s time period in California.
Yeah, the first band she put together after the Stone Ponies ended up becoming the Eagles, Don Henley, Glenn
Frey. Yeah, like,
Frey.
Would that have happened without her?
Who knows, but it certainly happened with her.
Well, when it comes to the artists that she was able to work with and create these sort of relationships with, one of the other things that I thought was interesting is that, unlike so many other rock stars that we hear about, you know, and I hate to say it, but the Eagles are a perfect example of when it goes south, it goes south, and nobody wants to speak to anybody anymore. But they all seem to hold Linda in such high esteem, no matter what, like over the years, et cetera.
Yeah, she's a great person. I mean, she's just somebody who's maintained her friendships, her relationships. And I mean, people have tremendous tremendous regard for her talent and her amazing voice. But I think she's just a really wonderful person that people maintain friendship with.
For her, it was always about the music. That the music was what would interest her. Celebrity didn't interest her. She never wanted to be a pop star. She considered that a circumstance that she had to contend with, but it wasn't her ambition. And I think that really speaks to her character and why people related to her professionally in the way that they did, and why audiences relate to her in the way that we do, because she's so real and authentic. And it's just the purity of the music. That's what interests her.
Well, there was a scene in the film where she's even talking about the importance of musicianship and not sort of getting sucked into the drug culture that was, well, I mean, it continues to be prevalent, but so much at that time, because, you know, she was saying, I believe, that sometimes when the guys become rock stars, then they feel as though they have to perform like a certain kind of masculinity, and then they lose their ability to be vulnerable and communicate that through music. And I remember she was saying, you know, and the music suffers. It's like she had a passion.
Yeah, and she was in her 20s then.
Yeah.
When she had those insights from her own experience as a woman in that situation. I mean, she was, you know, pioneering in that regard and having to figure it out, having to figure out the sexual politics of all that and navigate it, and at the same time have an analysis about it.
Which was amazing, considering I don't think there were really any sort of like, you know, people who she could follow. She was navigating this path on her own.
Yeah, there were not role models for her. She was the role model, and she had a really solid core. I think that came from her family. She always felt very close to her family, and for her, music was all about family. It was all about singing with people that she cared for and respected. And she thought of herself as a harmony singer. She calls herself a harmony singer, and I think that kind of is reflected in the way she navigated her career. She was very collaborative. And she was able to make the connections that allowed her to sing the different kinds of genres and styles that she branched out into.
And of course, speaking of the relationships that the film gets into, we also learn about how she definitely helped Emmylou Harris, mentored her, brought her out to her house, and, you know, pretty much was her hype man, if you will, yeah. All across California.
At a time when Emmylou was very down because she had just lost her partner, Graham Parsons, to heroin death.
And so why did you want to include something like that specifically to illustrate Linda's personality?
Well, it was important to show how the sense of sisterhood, lack of a better term, really came to be for her and for Emmylou, Bonnie Raitt, Carla Bonoff. They all speak to what it was like to be women in a male-dominated business and how they were very much there for one another. And that story of Emmylou clearly meant so much to Emmylou when she really credits Linda as saving her, just emotionally and psychologically saving her at a point where she was just really devastated.
All right. Now, of course, she doesn't have a perfectly smooth story in the music business. We learn about some of the bad managers that a lot of artists fall victim to. And one of them had something to do with her getting arrested by the FBI.
Yes, there's a story about some cut-rate tickets that her manager bought in the lobby of the hotel they were staying in. And
Linda, airplane tickets.
Airplane tickets. So they were on their way to Hawaii, and the FBI stopped them, and they spent the day in jail. They spent the day in jail. And she changed management at that point.
Of course, as she would immediately. Of the rest of her story, though, we also see her struggling a little bit with some of her own demons. Like you were saying at the beginning that when you found her story and she was like, well, nobody's really going to want to see a film like this. We learn that she had some confidence issues of her own.
I know. It's kind of hard to believe when you hear that voice because it's so confident and it's so commanding. And when she chose a song to sing, she really made it her own, and she sang it with such conviction. But yeah, I mean, I think she was continually challenging herself, and she was continually trying to sing in different ways and new kinds of music. And I think that would, you know, that would make anybody a little insecure. But I think the insecurity that she had was the kind that really pushes an artist to become more than they were, and to do new things and to perfect her style and her technique. So I think it was ultimately something that she was able to feed on creatively.
From her perspective, she says that she feels like she never really found her true voice until she started singing the mariachi music.
Oh, well,
that's
actually,
where she feels like she feels like she became a singer, is how she describes it.
And of course, she talks a lot about how that was the music that her father, who was Mexican, played a lot in the house. And we do have a clip of the mariachi music we can play.
I went to the president of my record company, who's a man who genuinely likes music. And I said, look, I've made all these records for you. They've sold this. I'm going to do this just for me. You know, and this might be self-indulgent. If it sells 2 copies, I don't care. But if I can't record this music, I'm going to die.
I don't understand any Spanish. I didn't understand how popular those songs were. But this is a lady who wanted to do it her way. And who was going to say no? Yeah. Canciones de mi padre. It's the largest selling Spanish language album in the history of the industry. That's the whole Linda Ronstadt story right there in a nutshell. Linda deciding she wants to do something. The record company telling her she can't. She goes ahead and does it anyway, and they jump on board as the thing starts to take off.
I think that's a beautiful example, again, of even somebody who might not have had a sense of confidence in themselves is still able to command a world that is just so harsh. But I want to ask, the film, of course, gets to the end, and we deal with her Parkinson's and the loss of her voice. How did she handle that, getting what I would imagine would be such a devastating diagnosis?
She handled it very characteristically with grace and with very matter-of-factness. I mean, she just now accepts that as the circumstance of her life. And it's limited her in terms of what she can do physically, but certainly not mentally. She's very engaged with the world. She's very engaged with her friends and her family. She's a voracious reader. So in terms of the quality of her life, I think she's enjoying it. But it was also a circumstance in terms of the making of the film, and that she really didn't want the film to be about her Parkinson's. So we respected that and understood her her intention there.
Of all of the honors that she's earned throughout her life, what do you think is she's still the most underappreciated for?
The versatility of her talent and her voice. I mean, how many rock stars do you know who can sing coloratura soprano and this kind of lusty Mexican folk music? I mean, she just uses such different parts of her voice, and she kept evolving and learning new ways of using her instrument that I don't think any other pop star, musical artist of that stature has ever done.
Even though there's a scene in the film where even though she's had Parkinson's, you still get to see her with her family, where music is still such an integral part of her life. And you were saying how she's so well-read and she still manages to create a full life for herself. Is that something that should be at least the takeaway for the audience, is that, you know, you can have, you know, something so devastating happen to you and yet still maintain a very full, very fruitful life?
Certainly, that's an important takeaway. I mean, there's so much about Linda's character, I think, that comes through in the film. She's such a humble person, and she, despite the fact that she was a superstar in her 20s, she never let it go to her head. I mean, she really maintained her own sense of humanity, and all the choices that she made reflect that.
All right. Well, I've been speaking with Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.